The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up.
CBS News Special Report.
It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glor.
We're going to begin with our interview with the president late this afternoon.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
A breakthrough in the investigation into more than a dozen package bombs.
They uncovered a latent fingerprint.
What's next for the caravan of migrants heading to the U.S.?
The caravan is more than a month away from reaching the closest point in the U.S.
The fallout from the murder of a Saudi writer.
The cover-up was horrible. The execution was horrible.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend with those bombs mailed to public figures and targets of President Trump. We learned Friday that authorities have arrested 56-year-old Cesar Sayoc and charged him with sending the devices. Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
He has been charged today with five federal crimes, including interstate transportation of an explosive, illegal mailing of explosives, threats against former presidents and certain other persons.
Sessions describes Sayoc as a partisan. FBI Director Christopher Wray says physical evidence ties him to the package bombs.
They uncovered a latent fingerprint from one of the envelopes containing an IED that had been sent to Congresswoman Maxine Waters. We have confirmed this fingerprint is that of Cesar Sayoc.
Sayoc was arrested at a South Florida auto parts store. Here's correspondent Manuel Bajorquez.
It is unknown at this point, at least officially, from those sources at the FBI, what the suspect was doing here. He does not appear to be an employee of this store, but some of the things that they mentioned in the news conference that he allegedly used to put those devices together, including batteries and wirings, those are things that typically you could find at a store like this.
One of Sayoc's friends, Justin Humberger, says he never showed any signs of extremism and didn't appear to have an interest in bombs.
He is very political. From like most of our conversations were governed around policies and stuff and things that like he goes so deep and it's so far out of my realm of thinking when it comes to government. But I would never think anything like this. This is very awkward.
The president addressed the packages Friday at a White House event.
We must never allow political violence to take root in America. Cannot let it happen. And I'm committed to doing everything in my power as president to stop it.
Opponents of the president say he's encouraged attacks and violence against many of his political targets and the media. Now to a group of migrants back on the road, traveling north towards the U.S.-Mexico border as President Trump backs away from his claim unknown Middle Easterners were mixed in with the caravan of migrants.
Less than 50 miles into Mexico and more than 1,000 miles from the U.S. border, the caravan of migrants paused. Some took the time to receive medical care. Others found fresh clothes, and children filled up on food donated by local residents. Candles were lit to honor a fellow migrant who died after falling off a truck earlier this week.
Hoy estamos de luto. Este compañero venía, o sea, venía con muchos sueños.
We're in mourning. He had many dreams, this man said.
You're going to find MS-13, you're going to find Middle Eastern, you're going to find everything.
After making those claims about the caravan on Monday, President Trump admitted he could not back them up.
There's no proof of anything. There's no proof of anything. But they could very well be.
This migrant from Honduras says he wants to tell the president that there are only humble, hardworking people in the group, no terrorists.
No somos ninguno terroristas.
More than 1,500 people have already dropped out of the caravan, choosing to apply for asylum in Mexico. For those who want to come to the U.S., Secretary of State Mike Pompeo sent a clear message.
Legal immigration is the surest way to obtain the better life you're looking for here in the United States of America.
The caravan is more than a month away from reaching the closest point in the U.S., and to make it to the San Diego border like a caravan earlier this year would double their journey. Laura Podesta, CBS News.
Hundreds of troops will soon be stationed at the southern border to support U.S. patrols there.
They will not be involved in apprehending illegal immigrants, but they would be allowed to erect barriers, police detention camps, and search for illegal border crossers.
Correspondent Cammy McCormick reporting. Turkey stepping up pressure on Saudi Arabia to extradite 18 people it says were involved in killing writer Jamal Khashoggi as the kingdom tries to defend itself.
Saudi Arabia is scrambling to carry out damage control. Extraordinary pictures in Saudi media show the King and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman delivering their personal condolences to Jamal Khashoggi's grieving brother and son. We can only imagine their feelings about the meeting, since many believe the Crown Prince was somehow involved in Khashoggi's killing. President Trump again stressed the importance of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, but he also sharply criticized the killing of Khashoggi and the Saudi deception that followed.
The cover-up was horrible, the execution was horrible, but they should have never been at an execution or a cover-up, because it should have never happened.
There's still no official word on what the Saudis did with Khashoggi's body. In Istanbul, police searched a car abandoned in an underground parking lot and registered to the Saudi consulate. But Turkish media is reporting they've found no significant evidence linking it to Khashoggi.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan stressed again that Turkey will not allow a cover-up over Jamal Khashoggi's death. Holly Williams, CBS News, outside the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul.
Khashoggi's eldest son has left Saudi Arabia and is now in the U.S. Matthew Shepard, the gay college student who was murdered 20 years ago, was laid to rest Friday at the Washington National Cathedral. More from correspondent Mola Lenghi.
It's an honor reserved only for the nation's most revered public figures. A funeral service at the National Cathedral in Washington. It's where Matthew Shepard was interred Friday. 20 years after his brutal murder, his remains were finally laid to rest. Matthew's father, Dennis, says his son would have approved.
He always had a fondness for the church and the ceremony involved with it.
In 1998, Shepard, a gay University of Wyoming student, was beaten, tortured, and tied to a fence in near freezing temperatures. Found by a passing bicyclist, the 21-year-old Shepard later died at a hospital. The hate crime sent shockwaves through the country. For 20 years, Judy and Dennis Shepard have wanted to somehow memorialize Matthew's remains, but worried about vandalism.
And that would just like killing Matt all over again. I couldn't deal with that.
When the Shepherds donated some of their son's items to the Smithsonian, the museum suggested a place of inclusivity, the National Cathedral.
It welcomes everybody who is considered different.
Matthew's funeral at the cathedral joins the memorial services of several U.S. presidents, national heroes like Neil Armstrong and John McCain. Matthew himself played a pivotal role in the LGBTQ movement. His murder shined a spotlight on LGBTQ hate crimes.
It woke people up to the fact that the progress we were making was not complete and it was not universal.
The hope is that Shepard will be a powerful symbol in this sacred resting place. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, Washington, D.C.
Coming up, an NBC star fades.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. I am Megyn Kelly. Thank you all so much for being here.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Efforts to protect election systems being put to the test as the U.S. works to secure them ahead of the midterms.
We are now in.
It only took seconds for security expert Harry Hursty to hack into this voting machine. Hursty is an organizer with DEF CON, one of the world's largest hacking conventions where even kids were able to penetrate voting systems.
There are hundreds and hundreds of known vulnerabilities in these machines.
Like a machine used in 18 states hacked in 2 minutes, a voting tabulator used in 23 states could flip the outcome of a presidential election, and a decades-old security flaw in that same unit still hasn't been fixed.
You wouldn't use a 10-year-old laptop with no software updates.
Protecting election infrastructure is a top priority for the Department of Homeland Security, which is deploying sensors to detect intrusions, particularly from foreign countries like Russia.
We're basically already at full activation. We're working with our state and local partners.
DHS Undersecretary Christopher Krebs says his agency and federal partners have set up a virtual command center on election day for local officials to report suspicious activity. In preparation, it participated in a summit this month with secretaries of state.
Doing things like tabletop exercises and scenario-based trainings.
All you have to do is to be as prepared as you can possibly be.
So far, Krebs says he hasn't seen the same level of activity from the Russians compared to 2016.
Does that worry you?
Sure, I have some concern that maybe we're missing something.
While U.S. intelligence agencies recently warned of ongoing influence campaigns by Russia, China, and other foreign actors, including Iran, they have no evidence of a compromise to infrastructure. But Hurstie warns the threat remains.
Every voting machine today, every voting machine in the future, all will be hackable.
Nicole Killian, CBS News, Washington.
The race for Florida's governor is heating up as the two candidates faced off in a debate.
How the hell am I supposed to know every single statement somebody makes?
Ron DeSantis offered a fiery defense of his decision to speak at events organized by an alleged white supremacist and rejected the notion that comments he had previously made were racist.
I am not going to bow down to the altar of political correctness.
I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist.
He was hit hard on the issue by Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, who faces scrutiny of his own after an ongoing state ethics probe revealed he received tickets to the Broadway show Hamilton from an undercover FBI agent investigating Tallahassee officials.
I am not the subject of an FBI investigation.
Gillum now says he believed his brother covered the tickets' cost by swapping them for Jay-Z and Beyonce tickets.
We got 99 issues, and Hamilton ain't one of them.
DeSantis wasn't convinced.
Why would an undercover FBI agent posing as a contractor give him a $1,000 ticket to Hamilton?
The race is seen as a referendum on both parties, as each candidate represents a specific style of politics. Gillum has styled himself as a progressive, and DeSantis is a staunch supporter of President Trump. While Gillum is ahead in the latest polls, and more than a million ballots have already been cast, experts are watching the reaction to the Hamilton revelations among late voters.
Correspondent Elaine Quijano reporting. Now to a CBS News investigation into AmeriCorps, the federal program that sponsors volunteers in underserved communities. A review of 5 years of complaints to the Inspector General who oversees AmeriCorps found allegations of sexual harassment, discrimination, hostile working conditions, bullying, and mismanagement at the program that receives hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding. One recent case revealed by CBS News finds the head of an Alabama nonprofit sent inappropriate messages to a young female AmeriCorps member who later resigned after saying she repeatedly turned down his advances. An investigation by AmeriCorps and its parent agency, the Corporation for National and Community Service, became mired this summer in bureaucracy amid delays and inaction.
AmeriCorps does not give enough support to its members.
This man, who asked not to be named, volunteered at a North Texas nonprofit where he says he was publicly ostracized for seeking grief counseling after two friends died. He says his concerns were ignored by an AmeriCorps coordinator.
I am disappointed. I feel that my case must have slipped through the cracks and that everybody that knew about the situation wasn't willing to address it.
Meanwhile, conservatives say AmeriCorps is poorly run and its federal parent, CNCS, has fallen short of its oversight responsibilities.
We have great concerns.
North Carolina Republican Congresswoman Virginia Fox chairs the Committee on Education and the Workforce.
We're going to hold the agency accountable.
A spokesperson for AmeriCorps says it prioritizes the safety of its members and expects organizations it grants money to meet reporting and conduct standards. And AmeriCorps has staunch defenders.
AmeriCorps is absolutely essential.
Shirley Sagawa runs Service Year Alliance. She says AmeriCorps volunteers help students and communities and that AmeriCorps builds them into responsible adults.
It prepares leaders. Makes people more civically engaged as adults.
But AmeriCorps whistleblowers, its critics, and Republicans in Congress say the organization needs desperate reforms to support and protect members while serving communities. Once a shining star at NBC, host Megyn Kelly is departing from her namesake show after an on-air apology for making controversial remarks about blackface.
I want to begin with two words. I'm sorry. I learned that given the history of blackface being used in awful ways by racists in this country, It is not okay for that to be part of any costume.
Her audience gave her a standing ovation, a stark contrast from the response she received after her divisive comments Tuesday.
You do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface for Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Like, when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character.
Megyn Kelly has faced criticism in the past for her controversial comments on Jesus and Santa Claus as a Fox News host in 2013.
And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white. Jesus was a white man, too.
This is a disaster scenario for Megyn Kelly.
Matt Bellany is the editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
She's hiring an attorney to protect her rights in this scenario, and my sources say she believes that the way that NBC is handling her is inappropriate.
Bellany also says Megyn Kelly has split from her talent agency, CAA, but it is unclear whether Kelly or the agency made that decision. Michelle Miller, CBS News, New York.
A planned Disney production by grade schoolers has been scrubbed. CBS News correspondent Pam Coulter reports.
A Maryland elementary school's decision to cancel a production of Aladdin Jr. has triggered a debate over whether it's a case of being sensitive to minority concerns or political correctness. One parent says her son dropped out of the play when he learned Arabs are described as barbaric in the script. When she took the issue to the principal of Westtown Elementary School near Baltimore, the school dropped the production, telling parents of drama club members the school wants to inspire respect for other cultures. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Up next, we talk with General Stanley McChrystal about leadership.
I think a leader actually is a person that emerges from the interaction between a leader and followers and then the unique context of a situation.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio presents the Intelligence Matters podcast, taking you inside the biggest stories in national security.
How concerned are you?
I'm concerned that the Russians never left.
Each week, former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, interviews top leaders from the U.S. intelligence community.
James Clapper, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, Mike Hayden.
And lucky for you, you won't need a security clearance to listen. The Intelligence Matters podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are beginning the final leg of their tour of the South Pacific, Australia, and New Zealand this weekend. It follows a brief moment of tension while the two were touring Fiji.
The traditional sounds of Fiji and cheers of the crowd have greeted the royal couple across the island nation.
Everywhere this royal couple goes, this is the kind of warm island welcome they're getting.
As they arrived at the University of the South Pacific, Prince Harry and Meghan were also given traditional Fijian leis, adorned with flowers, which they would continue to wear throughout the day.
Ulavanaka.
Meghan then gave her first speech on the tour, using her global platform to focus on education.
Everyone should be afforded the opportunity to receive education that they want, but more importantly, the education that they have the right to receive.
She told the crowd of her own grit and determination.
It was through scholarships, financial aid programs, and work study, where my earnings from a job on campus went directly towards my tuition, that I was able to attend university.
The American royal announced two grants aimed at empowering young women, the younger of which showed up in tiaras. But Meghan's day wasn't without a hiccup. A planned visit to a market was abruptly cut short.
Can we get out of the way?
Royal correspondent Roy Anika was one of the journalists with Meghan at the time.
What happened there?
I think she felt a little bit hot and flustered by the crowds there.
The demands of this tour have taken a little bit of a toll on her.
I think for Meghan, this being her first major overseas tour, she may have been caught slightly by surprise by how demanding each engagement is, how you have to put on a bit of a game face for each engagement. But that's the whole part and parcel of what comes with being a member of the royal family. You've got to put your game face on.
And Kensington Palace's official line is that security was concerned over the size of this crowd, though we do know that exhaustion has played a role in this trip.
Megan is 3 months pregnant. Earlier this week, she took some time off before rejoining the tour. Jonathan Vigliotti, CBS News, Suva, Fiji.
General Stanley McChrystal is out with a new book, Leaders, Myth and Reality. But before we get to your book, General, I want to ask you something very important. You led forces in Afghanistan. What's your reaction to the kind of violence we've been seeing there, especially recently?
Well, I think we've seen the headline recently when General Rasik, the Afghan police commander, was killed and General Miller was in the area. But I think the violence has continued. I think Afghanistan's in a difficult position. I don't think it's a lost cause, but I don't think it's an easy way ahead either.
What's next, then, for the U.S. there? What can it do?
Yeah, I think we've got to be very humble about what we can do. I think a negotiated settlement will be the outcome at some point, and hopefully that's sooner rather than later. I'm personally biased toward Afghanistan because I spent a lot of time there and I love the Afghan people. And so I don't believe that we should suddenly damn all of them as being corrupt or wrong. But I do think we need to be realistic about what's achievable.
Now let's talk about your book. You profile leaders, and they're not all from the same page. Walt Disney, Robert E. Lee, Martin Luther King Jr. are all subjects in this book. They're so different, though. What do you think they have in common?
Well, I think they all at some point were viewed as leaders, meaning they got people to do things or they caused things to happen. In some cases, they founded companies. In some cases, they were political leaders. In other cases, religious reformation. In every case, they were able to bring people to move in a direction and often using very different qualities and skills.
Is that how you define a leader, being able to motivate people?
I think that is actually too simplistic. I think a leader actually is a person that emerges from an interaction between a leader and followers and then the unique context of a situation. And from that, you get this leadership that comes out, almost like a chemical reaction. The leader is part of that equation, part of that process. But I don't think the leader is necessarily the dominant part of it, although we tend to want to think of it that way.
Do you think most of the folks that you profile in your book set out to be leaders, or is it part of that chemical reaction in that equation that you talked about?
I think it's part of the chemical reaction. If we take out Albert Einstein, for instance, he was a brilliant physicist. He became a leader partially because of his credibility in science, but partially because he had a very interactive nature with people. He wrote 30,000 letters in his lifetime. He brought along young physicists. He created in people a sense of community, and he entered a community of science that was nurturing for that, but he added to it. And he looked like our uncle. He looked like everybody's uncle. And so he made something very difficult approachable. And so in all of those ways, he brought us towards science. He led us in some directions, not only for science, but also for social causes.
What stood out to you in terms of the Achilles heels for some of these leaders? What brought about their downfall?
Yeah, in many cases, like Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Britain, you have a certain natural arc. She became very effective as a politician because she was very convinced of the righteousness of her policies. She pushed it. That was part of her selling point. That was what made her attractive. Over a number of years in office, however, that started to wear thin, and she developed a very centralized leadership style, almost autocratic. And people tired of that over time. So sometimes I think a leader tries to amass power and influence, and when they do, that can begin to work against them because people naturally start to reject it.
And Robert E. Lee, of course.
Well, Robert E. Lee's a fascinating case as an incredibly talented soldier, also a gentleman. If you and I had met him, you'd be struck by his courtly manners and his charisma. But in reality, he made a decision at a key point in his life to betray the country that he had spent 32 years in uniform for and to do it in defense of slavery. Now, we can talk about it. He was being loyal to his state or to the South. But in reality, it was what we would call a Plutarchian moment where he had the chance to get something right and he got it completely wrong. And so when we look at him as a leader, we've got to look at it with both sides of that. There's a conflicted story. Part of Robert E. Lee is extraordinarily admirable, and I still admire that part of him. But I think all of us also need to be realistic that many of our leaders have two sides.
General Stanley McChrystal on his new book, Leaders, Myth and Reality, on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Thanks, General.
Thank you.
Sinead O'Connor is making some major life changes.
Sinead O'Connor has changed her name and converted to Islam. She tweeted a photo of herself wearing a hijab this week and says her new name is the Arabic word for martyr. Last week, she posted a video of herself singing an Islamic call to prayer. In 1999, O'Connor was ordained as a priest, but has previously spoken out against the abuses of the Catholic Church. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Coming up on the weekend round of new details about Babe Ruth.
He wasn't an orphan, nor was he sent to reform school as a bad boy.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Jamie Lee Curtis is opening up about her addiction to painkillers.
In True Lies, Jamie Lee Curtis plays a housewife who unwittingly gets pulled into her husband's secret life as a spy.
I got you!
While making the movie, Curtis had a secret of her own. In opioid addiction, she hid from everyone, including her real-life husband. Curtis told People magazine she became hooked on Vicodin in 1989 following minor plastic surgery. I had been working on a movie, and the cameraman made a comment about my eyes being puffy, and I was mortified, she said. The rush of opiates was like the feeling of immersing myself in a warm bath.
She'd take pills when she could get them, and however she could get them.
Curtis told People's staff writer, Johnny Dawn, she bought drugs from a stuntman, rifled through friends' medicine cabinets, and even stole painkillers from her sister.
This was something she'd sort of do at the end of the day. Like some people drink a glass of wine, she'd pop a pill.
The 59-year-old actress has been candid about her drug problems before, like in this 2002 Entertainment Tonight interview.
I don't want to sugarcoat it. I think that these addictions are deadly.
Now, more than 115 people die every day from opioid overdoses, about 40% of them from a prescription drug. Ted Gustello is a certified addictions treatment counselor.
What's extremely significant to me is the pride she's taken in her recovery. I think it would be hard for people to hear that and not get hope.
CBS's Dr. Tara Narulo reporting. We're learning more about the life of Babe Ruth. Here's correspondent Peter King.
Author Jane Levy says there was one major drawback as she wrote her book, The Big Fella.
As Casey Stengel might have put it, everybody I need to speak to is presently dead.
But via Skype, Levy says digital technology helped her dig for previously hard-to-get information that allowed her to debunk several myths about the Babe. For example, he wasn't an orphan, nor was he sent to reform school as a bad boy.
He was sent off because of the disintegration of his family and because his father, when he got custody of the three surviving children of that marriage, didn't have the time or the interest in raising him.
All of that well hidden back in the day. Levy says that helped his rise as the first mass media sports star and celebrity endorser.
He comes along and he reaches the pinnacle of his powers, his ample powers, just as there's a revolution in this country in technology, marketing, PR.
Levy says the new information comes from years of digging through newspaper, state, and local archives made more available thanks to digital technology. But of course, she says you have to know where to look and what to look for. Peter King, CBS News.
An outbreak of a common virus turned deadly at a rehab center in Haskell, New Jersey, where seven children died. About 18 more are sick.
New Jersey health officials banned any new admissions to the Wanakee facility until the outbreak of adenovirus ends. The six deaths over the last 2 weeks occurred in the part of the facility licensed to provide long-term care for 92 pediatric patients. Adenoviruses account for about 5 to 10% of fevers in young children, and most patients recover after a brief illness. Symptoms include sore throat, runny nose, bronchitis, and pink eye. But according to the CDC, people with weakened immune systems, as well as those with existing lung or heart disease, are at higher risk of developing severe illness. In a statement, the New Jersey Department of Health said, "Unfortunately, the particular strain of adenovirus in this outbreak is affecting medically fragile children with severely compromised immune systems."
Patients at facilities like this tend to have severe underlying medical conditions. They may have breathing tubes. They could have a chronic lung disease or even HIV that makes their immune system particularly weakened, and that makes them especially targets for the adenovirus. Dr. John LaPook, CBS News, New York.
Officials have disclosed the first symptoms of the illness showed up a month ago.
U.S. health officials have approved the first new flu drug in 2 decades.
Zoflusa can kill flu in just a day, says Mark Eisner with Genentech.
It works directly to interfere with flu virus replication.
It's approved for people 12 and older, and he says it's just a single dose.
It's super important because it makes it very convenient and easy for patients to take.
Zofluza is not meant to replace being vaccinated. It should be available in a matter of weeks. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News, Atlanta.
The number of spam calls is on the rise as new technology is deployed to try and beat them. Here's correspondent Kenneth Craig.
This is an important message regarding your current credit card account.
Americans received 30 billion spam calls last year, and robocall blocking company Umail predicts next year half of those calls will be scams.
The reason of this call is to inform you that IRS is filing lawsuit against you.
Scammers often spoof calls, disguising the digits to make it look like a familiar number. But scam artists recently duplicated Beverly Figueroa's number and used it to spoof others.
Hundreds of phone calls.
People who received robocalls thought she had called them, and many called her back. There are several apps and features on the market that can stop many of them from reaching your phone.
And we're going even further to help you with phone calls.
Google just unveiled a new call screen feature on its latest Pixel phone. If there's a call from an unfamiliar number, you can have the phone answer for you. Artificial intelligence asks who's calling and why. You get a transcript of who it is, and then you can decide to pick it up or mark it as spam.
You'll never have to talk to another telemarketer.
And phone companies are developing new technology that goes one step further. It's called Stir Shaken and would require all calls to carry an authentic digital signature. That would ensure that the number you see in the caller ID is legitimate and not a spoof. Verizon says it'll start rolling out the system later this year. Other phone companies are expecting to have it in 2019. Many are hoping it will help bring an end to those annoying robocalls. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, New York.
The Trump administration is moving to do away with some protections for trans people.
I'm Gary Nunn. The Justice Department is essentially telling the Supreme Court it is lawful to discriminate against transgender people based on their gender identity. DOJ contends the federal civil rights law banning sex discrimination in the workplace does not extend to transgender people, that the ordinary meaning of sex does not refer to gender identity. Court is considering whether to rule in a case involving a woman who was fired from her job after she said she was starting gender transition. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
Artificial intelligence finds a new way to express itself at auction.
A painting created by artificial intelligence has sold at auction for more than $432,000, including fees. That's over 40 times Christie's presale estimate. The blurry portrait of a man named Edmond DeBellamy was generated by a Paris-based art collective using an algorithm and a data set of 15,000 portraits painted between the 14th and 20th centuries. The buyer is anonymous. Earlier this month in London, onlookers were astonished as the painting Girl with Balloon by the British street artist Banksy was shredded by a hidden mechanism in the frame as soon as the last bid was accepted. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News, New York.
Coming up, the country's newest billionaire added to a growing list.
There are now more than 2,100 billionaires in the world.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Sunday nights, Monday mornings, or Tuesday afternoons. You can listen to 60 Minutes whenever you want with the weekly podcast from CBS News.
How do we know you're telling the truth?
Because I have no reason to lie.
With hard-hitting investigative reports, interviews, and profiles.
Did these documents that you got prove corruption?
Absolutely.
From a variety of CBS News correspondents and contributors.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
For the biggest scoops and the best storytelling, subscribe to the 60 Minutes podcast today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Some of the artifacts on display at the Bible Museum in Washington have been ruled fakes.
Fragments that were purportedly part of the 2,000-year-old Dead Sea Scrolls have been on display at Washington's Museum of the Bible since it opened last year. But now, technical analysis has shown at least 5 of the museum's 16 fragments are likely forgeries. Museum Chief Curator Jeffrey Kloa.
The questions that have come up have been sufficient enough
that we're not confident in displaying them as authentic artifacts.
The fragments in question were purchased between 2009 and 2014 by the Green family, the evangelical owners of the Hobby Lobby chain of craft stores and the museum's largest donor. The tiny fragments were the museum's centerpiece collection, but there were concerns about their authenticity even before the museum opened.
We certainly had lots of questions, but we decided that this was an opportunity to help educate the public about different research methods.
The fragments went through multiple rounds of testing, first in 2016 by a team that concluded the markings were likely not 2,000 years old. Researcher Kip Davis.
The forgeries that I'm dealing with are ancient pieces of leather or parchments that have been written on in modern times.
Further technical analysis by a German company that used X-ray scanning along with ink and sediment analysis confirmed that the fragments are apparently forgeries. The Dead Sea Scrolls are believed to represent the earliest surviving pieces of the Old Testament and are worth millions to museums and to forgers.
A number of these institutions all own their own Dead Sea Scroll fragments and have paid an incredible amount of money.
Some biblical scholars say that fake fragments are being marketed to American evangelical Christians. As for the rest of this museum's fragment collection, they say they will get them tested and the results will be released. Chip Reed, CBS News, at the Museum of the Bible in Washington.
A store in South Carolina sold that more than $1 billion Mega Millions winning ticket.
Tonight's Mega Millions jackpot is a record-breaking $1.6 billion.
The lucky winner defied odds of 1 in 300 million.
On that Mega Mill number is 5.
A winning ticket has been sold right here in South Carolina.
And I'm trying to figure out who won the Mega Millions jackpot.
Big winner.
At that moment, millions of people across the country held on to a billion-dollar dream.
Read them and weep, people. I got the winning numbers.
I've been ready since 1967, and I'm 67 years old. It's about time.
At one point on Tuesday, California was selling 540 Mega Millions tickets a second. At Bluebird Liquor in Hawthorne, the line wrapped around the store.
I played to win.
There was only one jackpot ticket sold. So here's where the rest of the mega revenue goes. 50% goes to the prize pool, while the other 50% is allocated to state retailer commissions, vendor fees, and special causes. In South Carolina, lottery funds are used to support a variety of educational programs. 82% of funds go to college education and scholarships. The rest goes to programs for grades K through 12. It's unclear exactly where in South Carolina the ticket was bought, but it's a little bit of good news for a state still recovering from Hurricane Florence. South Carolina's governor estimated that hurricane caused $1.2 billion in damage to the state. That's still $400 million less than the value of the winning ticket.
Correspondent Mark Strassman reporting. Add that lotto winner to the growing list of the world's billionaires.
There are now more than 2,100 billionaires in the world, and their collective wealth grew by a fifth last year to nearly $9 trillion. 200 new billionaires were created, with China adding two a week. The report by UBS and PwC says a new breed of Chinese entrepreneurs is challenging Silicon Valley by developing new business models, seizing opportunities, and moving rapidly between business sectors. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Finally this weekend, correspondent David Martin meets Charlie McDaniel, whose father's remains were identified by Pentagon investigators after they were repatriated from North Korea nearly 70 years after he died.
He was just 3 years old when Master Sergeant Charles McDaniel went off to the Korean War and vanished without a trace.
He disappeared from history. I mean, he was just gone. He wasn't dead. He wasn't a POW that was listed.
He was a medic in an army battalion overwhelmed by Chinese troops at the Battle of Unsan in North Korea on November 2nd, 1950.
They lost 600 and some people in one night.
They were basically overrun.
The Chinese came in around them, surrounded them, and then just overran the battalion headquarters.
McDaniel's wife Gladys and their two sons never knew what happened to him. But when he didn't come home with prisoners of war, he was officially declared dead, a fact which slowly registered with Charles as he grew.
I remember all of a sudden, as a little boy, starting to cry. I was inconsolable.
He became an Army chaplain and searched military archives for his father's service records, but found no clues to his fate. Then North Korea turned over 55 boxes of remains following the Singapore summit.
55 boxes come back, that's 1% of the missing in action. So I'm figuring, at best, there's a 1% chance that my father's remains are there.
But then, as he revealed at a ceremony in Hawaii honoring the missing, he got a call from an Army official.
He said, "Well, I have some amazing news for you. We found one dog tag. One dog tag. And your father's."
Eaten away by rust, but still legible.
It has my father's name on it, his blood type.
You don't know what happened to your father exactly, but he could have been wearing that when he died.
And probably was. Probably was.
With the dog tag in hand, it didn't take long for the forensics lab in Hawaii to identify McDaniel's remains.
So they've done DNA analysis, they've done dental analysis.
Yes.
So it all adds up. Here's the opinion. Establish the remains as those of Master Sergeant Charles Hobart McDaniel.
Right. That's the definitive word that they got there.
Yep. Yeah.
While they were in Hawaii, Charles and his younger brother Larry asked for a moment alone with their father's remains.
I just put my hand on my father's skull, head, and said a little thank you prayer to God that even to have this, it's more than I ever expected, honestly.
I wouldn't ever use the word lucky with your situation, but...
Blessed is the word I would use.
Okay.
But fortunate. God's grace has somehow allowed this to happen.
Correspondent David Martin reporting. That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.